1914, Western Front. Millions of men are moving all directions. The French are driven back by the Germans. Joffre's Plan 17 failed miserably. The Germans managed to smash through Belgium. Smash Leeds. Smash Namur. But the one thing that the Germans didn't anticipate was smashing into the British Expeditionary Force at Mons. And it was at Mons where the Germans were taken aback, because they came across some of the most highly experienced troops on the battlefield in 1914. The bulk of the men that were at Mons had fought in the Boer Wars. They understood how to fight. And for those of you who may contemplate going into the military, I'm sure you'll find out quickly that the guys who actually saw the shit are the ones who know what they're talking about, as opposed to the guys that just go to classrooms and take theory. But the Germans, because it was the first army that smashed into the BEF, would prevail, due in part to changes in warfare, using air. What? Oh God, that guy's gonna be a pain in the ass. In particular, when the British launched reconnaissance plan. And they saw that the German army had actually spread out, that it wasn't a singular force going to Mons, but rather they intended to encircle it. So out of that sheer bizarre coincidence, that's what allowed the Germans to engage in a tactical retreat. So, in the end, we had an interesting series of developments on the Western Front. But the clearest element of it was the fact that Joffre's planning failed miserably. And he made some of the most critical type of mistakes that a commanding officer in a war can make. The first, he completely underestimated the enemy. He thought that the bulk of the German army would be down in Alsace and Lorraine. He didn't anticipate that most of the forces were what swept through Belgium. He thought that his little needle jabs would cause the Germans to reshift everything around, and they didn't. They kept moving forward with the Schlieffen plan. And simultaneously, he overestimated the ability of his own armies. He thought that he could completely disrail German movements. So if you're ever going to go into a leadership role, there's an old saying, the buck stops with you. Joffre got it 100% wrong. Underestimated, overestimated. In the end, his armies were driven in retreat. But here is the saddest aspect. In all of the reports that he made to Paris, he refused to accept the blame. He blamed his commanders in the field. He blamed his soldiers, going so far as to claim that the French soldiers lacked, and I quote, offensive qualities necessary to prevail. Imagine if your commanding officer basically said that your whole division had no balls.
Well, we don't exactly look at officers and think that they know everything. Well, anything.
I understand that. But the guy that has all the bars and the stars and suddenly basically saying, yeah, Marines have nothing. You know, I'm sure there would be quite a lot of anger and resentment.
Yeah.
Well, Joffrey was too good. He knew what he was doing. He knew better than everybody. But here we go. By the end of just August, the French army saw 75,000 men dead. On August 22nd, 27,000 died. One day, because of his incompetence. Plus, there were another 200,000 wounded or captured. And in the last 4 days of the Battle of Frontiers, he would lose another 140,000 men. It was bad. But it wasn't just the French. The German army in August suffered 200,000 casualties. Not as bad as the French, but still bad. And the Brits suffered 30,000 casualties. So men were dying because of his incompetence. Beginning on August 24th, the day after the conclusion of the Battle of the Mons, Joffrey ordered what would soon become known as the Great Retreat. French armies began, oh, I should have had a different map on here, but the French armies began shifting further to the left to meet up more with the British, to attempt to stop the flow of the Schlieffen Plan. But as they began to shift, they also began pulling back to try to get better defensible grounds. In doing so, they gave up almost all of Belgium. But this was not a defeat. No, no, no. In a letter that he sent to, there he is, the French defense minister, Adolphe Mazamet, Joffrey basically said, no, this retreat is a plan of recovery. He basically said, give me time and we will beat the Germans. He gave four reasons for it. The first, France had a string of fortresses like the Belgians had built. The most famous being Verdun, which we're going to talk about when we get to 1916. But all of the great French military fortresses are still controlled by the French. Of course, he didn't go to Liege or Namur and see the firing capabilities of the Germans, but we won't worry about that. He also argued that the topography was on the side of the French, because the great rivers, such as the Seine, had yet been violated by the Germans, and the mountains that actually existed along the Luxorian border, the Voorhees Mountains, those were still an impenetrable barrier to the Germans. So we had our defensive positions, we had topography. He also said that the spirit of the French army still survived. Vive la France! So he basically argued that the men understood that we're not retreating, we're withdrawing. And we're withdrawing in a cohesive manner to counterattack. Okay. What makes him think he's gonna win? Well, in his fourth point that he sent to Defense Minister Mazamet, he said, every mile the Germans advance, the longer their supply lines stretch. He basically argued eventually, like an elastic, you're going to pull it so far and then it's going to snap. So, in the meantime, what was the new plan? Well, very simple. We're going to focus on the left flank. We're not going to worry about
Alsace and Lorraine anymore, because each of these blue dots, those are some of the French fortresses. So we're going to keep men in the fortresses. We're not going to try attacking the Germans anymore through Germany. We're going to take advantage of the mountains that are going to protect us through Luxembourg. And instead, we're going to focus on the left flank. We're not going to allow the Germans to get around our position. This would be the new focus, right in this vicinity.
He would use the remnants of the 4th and the French 5th French armies, plus the British, and he would create a new army, a 6th army, which would be made up of reservists and extra troops that were not necessary from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd armies. So basically, instead of going this way as originally planned, he's going to spread everything out. And once he did that, then he would launch his new offensive from the position along the Somme. This would be the launching pad of the new strike. And this would allow the French and the British to outflank the Germans. Now, the reality of the situation was the bulk of the German troops were still fresh. Sure, in 12 days they conquered Belgium. But the guys, for the most part, had a leisurely stroll because it was the artillery that won the day. Plus, they managed to take control of Belgian rail lines. And once they could control the methods of transportation, the German soldiers could be transported with ease. And the Germans were pumped up because, well, they rolled over the Belgians. They kicked the snot out of the French. So they were all fired up. They were ready to go. So as the French pulled back, as the British pulled back, the Germans were actually eagerly in pursuit. They saw the end of the war days away. The Brits, on the other hand, in total movement over a span of about the same 12 or 13 days, a typical British soldier had to walk 250 miles. So they definitely were more exhausted than their German counterparts. Plus, as the British and the French retreated, they had to stop, turn around, and hold the Germans back, and then retreat again and repeat. And that slowly saps the strength and abilities of any fighting force. Germany was on the cusp of victory. Questions? And then Germany made a mistake. Huge blunder. Since 1906, 1905, the plan to deal with a two-front war, which was developed by Field Marshal von Schlieffen, was straightforward. You take your 7 armies, you have your 3 armies, which are essentially going to be like a flying wing. You roll through Belgium and you ensnare Paris between the 1st and the 2nd armies. The 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 6th, and 7th will shatter all of the other fortress cities. And then once the French surrender, as they have a tendency to do, like it had happened in the Franco-Prussian War, the bulk of the German forces would then be transported to the west. Sorry, to the east. We'll deal with the Russians. That was the plan. However, as events began to unfold, Schlieffen's replacement, Helmuth von Moltke, known to history as Moltke the Younger. The reason being was his uncle, Moltke the Elder, was the principal architect of Bismarck's Wars of Unification. Well, Moltke was originally committed to the Schlieffen Plan, but as the German armies rolled through Belgium, he made two critical changes to the Schlieffen Plan. The first is here. He shifted the First Army's trajectory. Instead of being the flying wing, which would outflank Paris, he instead ordered the First Army to squeeze closer to the Second and to simultaneously go directly at the city. By doing so, he exposed the flank of the German assault. There was nobody here. He's doing this at the same time as Joffre is planning his stance. Joffre shifting people over here to the left, just as Moltke is shifting people to the right. Essentially, he's going to walk right into the shifting French and the British. And then, as if that was not bad enough, as we're going to see when we start talking about what was going on in the East, he freaked out by a near loss on the Eastern Front. So he took two corps from the First Army. The First Army, which was the strongest, most powerful of all seven German armies on the Western Front. He cut their strength by a third. So he weakened the wing and he shifted the wing. And the end result was he stepped in it. And then if that wasn't enough, once he gave those orders, on September 2nd, 1914, he gave new orders. He ordered the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th to change their trajectory to focus on Verdun. The Schlieffen Plan was about spreading everything out, stretching the lines in mass penetration. And what is he doing? He's condensing the lines, bunching everyone together. Why? Well, Moltke believed if they could take Verdun quickly, that would be a symbolic defeat, almost as significant as taking Paris. Well, the problem is you deplete the first, it means you're relying upon the second, which of the seven armies was the smallest, and you shift that their supporting forces, 3, 4, and 5, farther away. By the way, General Gluck of the First Army was so angry, he refused to take calls from Moltke. Now, one of the advantages the Germans had is everywhere they went, they brought phone lines with them, which allowed the commanding or the chief of staff to have complete control over all the forces. But now you have the commander of the army that basically was just cut in a third, and he's pissed. So if there's calls for change or support or new orders, he's not taking the call. So as a result, he kept walking. And he didn't know he was walking into a trap. Now, at the same time this is all going on, Paris is starting to prepare for a siege. biggest threat to Paris was every single foot that the Germans marched closer to Paris, the closer their big guns were coming in range of the city. So, the Parisian government made a fateful decision. The entire government and close to a half a million of its citizens, the weakest, the women, the children, the elderly, were all removed from the city. They basically abandoned the city. But as they withdrew, that left only reserve soldiers. And what did the reserve soldiers start doing? Well, they literally began making defensive positions. The men folk, any able-bodied, fit man stayed to remain behind to do work within the city to make defensive positions and structures. And they would go so far, I love this, they would set up searchlights and machine gun emplacements on the Eiffel Tower. They were preparing themselves for urban warfare, anticipating that the Germans are going to come. So now, the French are shifting to the left, the Germans are shifting to the right, and the target that could have ended the war is suddenly becoming more fortified. And it's at this point that Joffre orders a strike. And the counterstrike to the German advance is the second major battle of the Western Front. The First Battle of the Marne. Gluck, because he refused to take phone calls, was not aware of the shift in position of the British Expeditionary Force and the French Fifth, as well as the creation and advancement of the French Sixth. So here's Gluck, marching blindly to the south, heading to Paris as he was ordered, angry that he lost a third of his troops. And what does he stumble upon? Well, here's the Brits, here's the French 6th, and here's the French 5th. Literally walks into them. Even though German intelligence reconnaissance pick this up. But see what happens when you don't take a phone call? At the same time, the French 4th Army shifts quickly and goes to strike at the advancing German 2nd Army. In effect, they caught them, both armies, in a bowl. Over the next 3 days, the French and the Brits pound the German forces. It became so bad that Moltke feared both the first and the second would be completely encircled. He was on the verge of losing two of his 7 armies. So he orders them quickly to retreat. So over the next 4 days, ending at September 13th, not that you need to remember the dates, the Germans, who got within eyesight of Paris, at the closest, Gluck's army was 16 miles away from Paris. Suddenly they had to turn around and they would retreat 40 miles. Quickly running, just like the British had done previously. But they would retreat
to right about here, the Anz River.
And they did something radically different. Instead of continuing their retreat, the Germans secured their positions and began preparing the first trenches that were created on the Western Front. They literally dug in, and the Germans would roughly hold that position for the next 4 years. Why? The 19th century style of warfare. You move your men, you take ground, and then you wait for the diplomacy to set in. So Moltke decided, this is what we're going to take. All of Belgium almost, and a little chunk of French territory. Now let's start negotiating an end to the war. Unfortunately for the Germans, 15,000 Germans were captured in the sudden retreat. They lost 30 of their bigger field guns and about 300 machine guns. So even though they were almost shattered and they managed to retreat, big. But here's the amazing thing. In this battle, which lasted from the 6th to the 13th, 2 million men engaged in combat at the Battle of the Marne. And casualties were extraordinary. Both sides suffered approximately 250,000 casualties each. 500,000 men, 25% of the fighting force, shot, injured, or killed. The French lost the most. 80,000 French soldiers died over the course of a week, compared to 1,400 Brits and 67,000 Germans. But this was horrifying. Not only about the amount of men that were fighting, but the level of death. The world had never seen anything like this in scale. But ultimately, this was the first victory enjoyed by the French and the Brits. And ultimately, it was the Battle of the Marne that forced the Germans to abandon the Schlieffen Plan. Germany was desperate to hold the ground that they took. So instead of advancing anymore, they dug in. Now Moltke had the difficult task of relaying this information to the Kaiser. In his report, Moltke, almost foreseeing what would happen, actually included the line, "Your Majesty, because of this defeat, we've lost the war." He had it. He realized he had it. And he realized he screwed up. He would tender his resignation on September 14th. He would be replaced by Erich von Falkenhayn, who would focus less on an offensive war, but would be content to fight a static war. Not a fluid war. Static war. And why? Because the Battle of the Marne triggered what became known as the Race to the Sea. From September until November, both sides attempted to outflank the other and continued to race towards the English Channel. This was triggered when Falkenhayn, the new chief of staff, shifted the German 6th Army from Lorraine and the 4th Army from Luxembourg to go around the 1st and the 2nd, leapfrogging. So he took strength from the south where the French weren't going and shifted it to the west, exactly where the French were going. But of course, that created a stalemate. The French, the Brits, and the surviving Belgian soldiers all tried using the railroads to outpace the German positions. But it was not fast enough. The German speed was breathtaking. And in total, 5 major battles were fought in the span of 3 months. But none of these battles was a decisive win. The forces came together and smacked into each other. And then they tried going north and smacked into again and again and again, always trying to outflank until they literally ran out of land. It was bizarre. It was unprecedented. But you had combatants that had equal strength. Neither side had an overwhelming superiority. So in the end, they literally hit the English Channel. And they soon realized, in doing so, they created a 400-mile front that would stretch from the English Channel all the way to the border of Switzerland. And for the next 4 years, those would be the lines. Yeah, you take a little ground, but then you'd have to give a little ground. And then you take a little ground, and then you'd have to give a little ground. Over and over and over and over again. Now the Germans would make one last attempt to break through, to outflank the British and the French. In the 5th of the 5 battles, known as the First Battle of Ypres. Ypres was a Belgian province. Right here. Almost at the English Channel. In a part of Belgium called Flanders. Flanders is a vast, flat plain that stretches for miles on end. The plain is completely surrounded by canals that link all of the towns together. Because for hundreds of years, that's how goods traveled back and forth. You'd put your stuff on a barge and you'd sail it to the next town. But the interesting thing about the Flanders Plain is it's just a few feet above sea level. So the water table is just below the surface. You could dig down 2 or 3 feet, and then you end up with nothing but mud and water. So what happens? Well, during the fall, when the waters rise, much of the plain turns into what I've had described to me as mud. That has the consistency of like cream cheese. Just soft and gooey. The only way to travel from the fall into the winter time are a series of raised road beds. Because this is what it looks like. It just looks like mush. If you don't walk along the paths that were built hundreds of years ago with all of the stone that was raised, you're basically going to end up hip deep in mud. And then, when the winter time comes in, the muds freeze, which makes it possible to walk on the mud, but they thaw in the spring real quickly. So you cannot take an army and reposition them, because if they stay too long, they're going to end up... Yeah. All right. Dnipro was a fortified town, not to the scale of Liege or Namur, but it was a fortified town just north of the French border. This was an ancient town that had castle walls built around the heart of the city, going back to the Napoleonic Wars. And you had the classic triangle star fortification walls. So that way when the cannonballs would come in, you know, you wouldn't have a direct line. But from all of these positions, they were able to put, you know, cannon defenses, artillery. So you can see the wall on the outside of the city. This picture was Ypres in 1901. This is where the end of the housing stopped because the wall is over here. And again, this is a good shot of the wall and the defensive positions. There's the cathedral right there. So nothing like Liege and Namur, but still it was a hard target. So the plan was whoever could take the city before winter essentially would have control of the flank. So both sides, who already were exhausted, limped into one another and gave everything they could. But neither side could get an actual victory. The armies began running out of ammunition. Morale began to crumble because they thought this war would be over in weeks. Some units on both sides actually refused to engage. And it's there when the commanding officers began realizing there is going to be no more fluidity. The war is going to shift to a static war. The Brits and the French, they would create improvised positions to do their best to hold off the German advance. And they were able to do so for 4 weeks. But the result was, as wave after wave of Germans tried coming to penetrate and take the city, casualties again went through the roof. On the Allies side, sorry, I'm doing the mental math, you had about 180,000 Belgian and French and British soldiers killed in action. On the German side, 150,000. Take two bricks, smack it together. That's essentially what happened. They went to they could not fight anymore, and neither side could tip the tides. I got one little interesting little side note, little factoid for you as well. You're never going to believe who fought in the Battle of Ypres.
Hitler.
Adolf Hitler. Wait, there we go. Here we go. Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was there. He was an infantry soldier in the 6th Reserve Unit in the Bavarian Army. And his regiment saw catastrophic casualties. Out of the 3,600 men that were in his unit at the beginning of Ypres, 3,000 of them lost their lives. 3,000 out of 3,600. Ironically, at Ypres was the only time Hitler earned a promotion. He was promoted from private to lance corporal. And it was there at that battle that he realized he didn't want to be in the infantry anymore. So he actually would request and would be granted a change in position. He would become a dispatch runner. So it was his job to take orders and to run trench to trench to trench. Why did he do it? He was fast and he was athletic. And he felt lucky. Hitler would remain in the war all 4 years. All right, questions? Well, after Ypres, it was clear to both sides that this war would be something that was unforeseen in all of the nation's pre-war plans. All of the plans were based on quick flanking maneuvers, taking positions, and then sitting down and engaging in a negotiated settlement after an armistice. But that was not going to happen. On the German side, Falkenhayn would order the German soldiers to focus on building defensive positions. Which, of course, ironically, is the exact opposite of the Schlieffen plan. Why? Well, it was the Germans who first realized, okay, if you take a bunch of men and you cause them to charge over a vast plain, and the enemy are kind of dug in somewhere, what's going to happen to your men as they charge across the plain?
They're going to get mowed down.
They're going to get mowed down. So what did the Germans decide to do? Well, we're going to be the ones who are going to dig down. And beginning in 1914 and continuing all the way until 1918, the Germans would bring in expert engineers that would begin transforming literally trenches that were dug in the muck to more secured, protective positions that soon in time would have underground bunkers encased in concrete and continued lines of positioned machine guns staggered throughout the lines, allowing you to defend the whole row. Falkenhayn realized men versus bullets. Bullets are going to win every time. And plus, if you think about it, why would they not want to? Why would you not want to? You have more materiel than men. If you build a concrete bunker, it can take bullets. It can take a pounding, unlike a human being. And if you protect those positions with overwhelming fire, the enemy's not going to be able to displace you. The whole idea is you've now taken over Belgium. You now have a foothold in France. If you hold those lines, eventually the French are going to want to give up. The French people are going to be tired of the war. And then they're going to want to negotiate. And you have a huge bargaining chip. You'll negotiate French lands, maybe for lands in Africa or somewhere else on Earth. Or maybe you'll take more French territory beyond Alsace and Lorraine, but we'll give you back northern France. You know, you have all the chips. And another interesting thing was unlike the French and the Brits, the German officers began making contingency plans to allow their frontline soldiers to pull back to other defensive positions that were being built in the rear. So they gave their line the ability to flex, which would give them a greater chance of being able to rebound. And I've already said why. I got ahead of myself. Why were they willing to do this? They already had territory of the enemy in their hands. And by holding the land, that gave them an advantage in negotiations. Now, bizarrely, on the other side, England and France, the exact opposite. The exact opposite. In 1914, the Brits and the French refused to dig in, refused to contemplate these permanent structures, because in their mind, by pulling back, well, that would be a political nightmare. When the elections roll around, what are the people going to say when they read the newspapers? And they realize, oh, there's Germans holding French territory. And the French army was forced to retreat. All wars are shaped by politics. Heck. The last time we actually won a war was 1945. We didn't win in Korea. We didn't win in Vietnam. We definitely didn't win in Afghanistan or Iraq. Yeah, I know. All because it was controlled by politicians. Politicians don't care about the boots on the ground. Politicians at the end don't care about achieving a moralistic victory. Politicians just want to get reelected. So they got to put their finger to the wind. Well, what are the people happy about? What are the people angry about? Well, you know, the one way not to get elected is to sit back and say, yep, well, we're going to retreat. So as a result, the politicians who would actually order the British and the French soldiers not to build fortifications. Because where the lines were, they had already given up ground. So by digging in 10, 50, 100 miles in your own territory, that's an admission of defeat. So while the Germans were digging in and trying to keep themselves warm in the wintertime, the British and the French did the exact opposite. Yeah, sure, they dug some trenches, but they didn't seek a permanency to them. It was nothing but ruts in the ground throughout most of the war. Plus, in their minds, why are we going to waste the material building these fortified structures? Because all of the trenches are going to be launch pads to take our territory back. Which is going to happen next week or next month. Well, as a result of this, it would be the British and the French who would essentially make a catastrophic blunder. Say what you want about the Germans, but the Germans adapted to the developments in 1914, where the British and the French did not. They continued to apply the old principles of 19th century war. And as a result, their strategy for the next 4 years was the same, like a broken record over and over again. Deploy your artillery.
bomb the enemy positions to soften them up. Then order your infantry to leave your trenches and race at the artillery pocked lines of the enemy. And then once the infantry penetrates, bring up your cavalry behind and take the position and continue to advance.
Throughout the entire war, almost, Allied commanders believed they were just one breakthrough away from winning the war.
But they never took time to observe the way the German defenses would develop. And we're going to see them when we get to 1915. Literally, they began bringing in concrete. The German trenches were concrete bunkers, thick, steel reinforced. And they had retreat positions. Did you see 1917? That scene when they got through no man's land and they went into the German positions? Weren't the soldiers amazed? That was very good acting, by the way. And what they saw? Germans were in it for the long haul. But the Allies figured, no, we'll be able to break through and then we'll win.
And thus, more so than the Germans, but it was actually the French and the British that would create the deadly Catch-22 that prolonged this into a four-year conflict. Because what happened? Well, when they failed to break through the German lines, they simply decided we need more artillery to blow up more holes. And then we need more infantry that will be rushed through the holes. And then we need more cavalry to bring up the rear. Not realizing all they were doing was creating more and more death.
They were also obscuring their line of advance because with no man's land, all those holes everywhere, the sinkholes and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Can you advance through that?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. So they were wasting artillery shells and men and material on a battle that they weren't going to win it to begin with.
Right. Not at least the way they thought they were going to win.
Nope.
Yeah. Actually, when we get to 1915, where we'll deal with, there was a change in command on the British side. And one of the things that is shocking, the British soldiers were actually ordered to walk through no man's land. Because the Brits felt that if everyone charged, there would be a breakdown in command. So instead, everyone had to walk so the officers could keep control of the men. 100, 200 yards across. Yep. But I also have to be fair as a historian. I'm always trying to be fair. We cannot play the armchair warrior. It's easy to criticize the perspectives today, but you got to realize at the time they thought they had enough men to actually accomplish the goals. They thought they had enough artillery and ammunition to accomplish their goals. The Allied tactics were based on returning the war from a static war back to a fluid war. They thought if they could punch through the lines, that would cause the Germans to have to reshift and begin retreating and repositioning. It just never happened. And heck, even on Armistice Day, the Germans, for the most part, were still where they were in 1914 because of the defenses that were made. So, again, it's easy for us today to sit back and say, duh, what are they, dumb? But again, unless you've been in combat, you know, all the rest is just theory. But here is the truth of the matter. Once the Germans dug in and the Brits and the French couldn't break the lines, you had this static war materialize, and essentially it became a war of attrition. The generals stopped necessarily being concerned with taking specific points of strategic interest and instead focused on body count. How many men are we going to need to take what we want? Or what were our losses as a result of this move? Ground became immaterial. The goal was to kill as many of the enemy as possible, because the more dead enemy, the weaker they are, and the more likelihood they're going to pull back and the war is going to come to an end. But in throwing your men into the meat grinder, that's also going to impact morale at home. Because as I said last class, you know the one thing that mommy and daddy do not want to see?
Body in a casket.
Body in a flag-draped casket coming home instead of their son. And the more images of that are seen in the villages, in the towns, in the cities, the more and more the people sit back and say, we got to end the war.
And here's my most recent edition based on a new book that I read in preparation for this semester.
One thing that I always forgot to acknowledge, because it's not often mentioned by many historians, was this biggest truism. Another reason why the static war developed was the overwhelming offensive action from the end of August to November caused both sides to literally run out of ammunition. These were all the shells that were fired at the Battle of the Marne. This is just one battle. We're talking thousands and thousands of artillery shells. Are your factories at home able to match the rate of fire of the artillery crews? And then what about transportation of those shells from the factories to the battlefield? It is. It very is. So ironically, the static war was actually cheaper. It actually became cheaper. Because when we think of war, we think of constant battle. But the truth of the matter is what would develop along the Western Front is you'd have days, weeks, months of you being in a trench and not a single shot being fired. So as this war progressed, it actually required fewer and fewer shells, because there was less attempts to cause this massive shift. It was so bizarre. But it also would give the rise of new types of shells. Out went the high explosive shells that could cause big booms, and in comes nasty shells like shrapnel shells that would be fired over the enemy line and would explode and would send red hot steel flying down in all directions. Now, of course, it would take the factories months and months and months to build up enough of supply to be able to have devastating effect, but that's what they were working towards. And also, when we talk about the development and use of gas, it's another reason why those nasty things were developed. Maybe this could be the one tool that could help us get that little bit of an advantage over the enemy. Questions? How is that possible? Oh, because we end at... Okay. All right, do I have enough time to do this? I don't. So I'm going to save this. This is a really good thing. So I'm going to let you go early. All right, questions.
So, I did not have a chance to finish your exams. I got stuck being a lawyer.
yesterday. As I told my other class that took their exams, my advice to you is when you finish college, get one job. Don't get multiple jobs. So like, I'm a teacher, but I'm also a lawyer. And sometimes the teaching interferes with the lawyer, and sometimes the lawyer interferes with the teaching. So my wonderful plans of having all day yesterday to grade exams blew up, and I was gone almost all the day. So I'm going to try to work on them tomorrow. I'm going to try to work on them over the weekend. I don't really care about the Super Bowl, so I'll probably be working on exams when that game's on. My hope is I'll have everything done by Tuesday. Now, as far as the exams go, again, I haven't looked at them, so I can't say how anyone did. But keep in mind, you all have the ability to earn extra credit. I put on sale at the bookstore, I don't know if they're still there, two books. You got the textbooky, that is some kind of following along as far as the progressive history, and you also have the little book, All Quiet on the Western Front. If you didn't think you did well on the exam, take one or two or three chapters and do like reviews and send them to me. For every single submission that comes out of All Quiet on the Western Front, I'll give you up to 10 points, extra credit points, that will be added into the overall sum of your points. So again, if you didn't think you did great, you have the opportunity to earn extra credit. And I'd be willing to give up to or allow, the entire book. Plus, they said you could also do like movie reviews if you wanted it, if you could find a movie that's related to World War I. Same thing, watch the movie, tell me what it's about in two or three pages. I won't grade those based on grammar or anything like that. I won't hold you to the same standards as the paper, but give you a chance if you are interested in this stuff to dig down a little deep and earn some extra points. And my advice is to do it now rather than wait, because when we get to May, and if your average is it's probably going to end up whereas if your first exam was well, now would be a chance to kind of kick yourself in the butt a little bit and push yourself forward, all right? All right, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you all on Tuesday. Hey, Josh. Not Josh. Jacob.
Yeah.
Did you take the test?
Yeah, I took the test.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. We'll see ya. Chris came in. Jacob was here. Josh was here. He has got the plague. She was here. You're good. He's good. Deshaun came in. Well, that's what.